All right, good morning. I don't know if any of you were there, but Professor Smith and Professor Goldberg had a fantastic panel on Monday where they got to vent about the problems that they saw with public health law, so this is my turn. So I'm going to talk about a couple different examples from a couple different contexts, and I think that when you step back and look at them together, there might be a bit of a pattern emerging that is problematic and says something important about public health law. I also could be entirely wrong about that. So I would love your feedback on that, and I'll try to be a little bit provocative as I do that. I got into thinking about this set of issues when I was working on New York City's portion size case, which probably needs no introduction. I spent a lot of time working on that this past spring, and actually the spring before that too. I was involved at two different levels in writing amicus briefs on behalf of the city that were joined by a whole number of public health groups, including APHA actually. And as you all know, New York City proposed this portion size limitation. There was a lot of opposition, including, well, largely funded by the industry, such as this sign that appeared really all over the city. And the law really became fairly unpopular. How much of that was driven by industry-funded opposition and how much of that was independent of that is a little hard to figure out, but there was a lot of criticism crystallized by noted commentator John Stewart, who said it combines the draconian government overreach people love with the probable lack of results they expect. And if you remember that bit, it was really driving home those two themes. One was, you know, this is sort of Bloomberg's nanny state trying to intervene in every piece of people's lives, and at the same time, John Stewart sort of pulled out all of the other really horrible, unhealthy things that you could eat in New York City that were not covered by this restriction, and tried to show that, well, this was ridiculous because you can still get your, massive pastrami sandwich, but now you just can't get the drink to go with it, and that made no sense. That sort of echoed the main criticisms that were heard, and it was a pretty devastating critique, but John Stewart is not known as a legal analyst. It was a powerful critique of the policy, maybe, but it's not a legal argument against this type of regulation, or so I thought. Then the trial court issued its decision, which basically followed the John Stewart doctrine. And if you look at that, the trial court's decision had basically said the same thing. The challenge was really about, the legal challenge was to whether the Board of Health had the authority to adopt this type of regulation. And the court said, well, the board lacks the authority to do this, in a sentence that I'm still puzzling over and makes no sense at all. It says, the law clearly said, it's there in quotes, the board has the authority to control chronic disease, but it says the conclusion of the court was the board lacks the authority to limit or ban a legal item under the guise of controlling chronic disease. And then, at the same time, it said, well, also this is under-inclusive. It's not, there's too many loopholes in this, and that's also a problem for this regulation. So, what struck me is that there were these two criticisms that didn't really seem to go together. The court is saying, this is overreach, you're going too far. At the same time, you're not going far enough. You can't do this, but if you could, you'd have to do it 100%. So this went up, I'll skip the intermediate court, it went up to the New York Court of Appeals, which is the highest state court in New York, and it wrapped both of these concepts into its separation of powers analysis and brought in this idea of compromise. It said the portion cap rule embodied a compromise that attempted to promote a healthy diet without significantly affecting the beverage industry. and you might think that that would be okay. But it saw compromise itself as being a problem. And it said, well, because it was a compromise, the Board of Health was engaged in lawmaking that was beyond its regulatory authority. And then it said such a policy or such policymaking would not be implicated in an outright ban of a toxic substance. So it was a little bit wishy-washy on whether sugary beverages counted as a toxic substance. So the lower court was basically saying you can't do this, but if you could, you'd have to do it 100%. The Court of Appeals here was almost saying you can't do this because you didn't do it 100%. If you're going to do this, these exceptions are making it so that you can't do it. And that struck me as odd and potentially a really problematic legal doctrine for public health, because I think compromise and moving incrementally are hallmarks of public health and incredibly important to public health. So this is just one case. It's one state court case, but I don't think it's an isolated case. And actually, the opinion was followed very closely on an earlier New York case called Borrelli, which dealt with restrictions on smoking in public places, where the court had said very similar things in the context of smoking, basically saying that because, in this case it was the state, but because the state board included exceptions, that invalidated the entire thing, that either smoking was dangerous and you had to ban it everywhere, or you couldn't do anything about it. And that's I think, an odd doctrine that doesn't get applied in most contexts, but does seem to get applied in new areas where boards of health are moving into new areas that they haven't previously been involved in. I think there's sort of this reflexive notion that there's something wrong with this. Now people are overstepping their bounds and they shouldn't be dealing in this area. And that leads to, I think, very problematic decisions like this one, which then circle back and become a problem for public health more generally. So the problem is, you could call it this sort of implicit all or nothing rule, that compromise and incrementalism are not appropriate in public health. And you know, I think for everyone here, that should strike you as problematic. Every public health regulation is drawing lines in some way, and because there's a food safety violation in a restaurant doesn't mean that you go board the place up and you shut the place down. You're always sort of trying to draw lines between what is the public health issue that we're dealing with, and what are the other considerations that come into play, whether it's business rights or individual rights and so forth. And exceptions can have very reasonable explanations. A lot of the amicus brief that I wrote working on the New York case was trying to explain there are exceptions here, but the exceptions have very good reasons for them. And one perfectly good reason for an exception is a limitation on enforcement authority. You can't enforce everywhere all the time, and you should be able to set priorities. And in New York, it was even a jurisdictional question that the Board of Health just simply didn't have jurisdiction over certain types of establishments, and therefore couldn't have a rule that covered those types of things. So another type of exception that I think is appropriate and reasonable that we'd want government to be thinking about is individual autonomy and individuals' ability to make their own choices. And so what struck me as really the most problematic part of that New York Court of Appeals opinion was the part of the decision where it said this type of regulation limiting the portion size was a sort of nudge, based on the behavioral economics type of reasoning that you're changing the default. And the court went out of its way to say, well, that's an inappropriate thing for boards of health to be doing, because that shows that they're impermissibly involved in policy making. So this got me thinking about this all or nothing type of reasoning, and whether it was popping up in other contexts as well. So I want to talk about a couple other contexts quickly and then talk about the bigger picture. So also done a bunch of work on First Amendment issues, and this is an area where I think the same type of thing is coming up in an maybe even more problematic context, because for boards of health, you can sort of see the idea that they're regulatory agencies. They have to stay within the lines of what the legislatures told them. Here, you see courts striking down what legislatures are doing. And I'll just talk about Sorrell versus IMS Health, which is the last Supreme Court decision on commercial speech. And the court struck down a Vermont law that prohibited the use of prescriber identifying information in pharmaceutical marketing. So the companies were getting the information and basically using it to pressure physicians to prescribe their drug. Vermont saw this as problematic, prohibited the use for that purpose. What the Supreme Court did was strike down this law in part because they said, well, this is a content-based or speaker-based restriction. You are singling out the people who are using this information for marketing purposes and prohibiting their use of this information. And there was importing this notion of content-based and speaker-based from outside the commercial speech context and from the more general First Amendment context and bringing it in, which Justice Breyer pointed out in dissent is a problem, because regulations are all about picking out the people to whom the regulation applies and you know, applying the regulatory scheme to those people. And Justice Breyer, as he tends to do, went through in his dissent all of the terrible things that would follow if you actually took the majority's reasoning literally, and some people would rather that he stop doing that because it sort of creates a roadmap for other people. But you know, the result of this is the same thing. The court is saying this is sort of all or nothing. Either you're prohibiting everyone from using this information, or you're prohibiting no one from using this information. Although I really think it's sort of a nothing rule, because if you actually tried to apply it to everybody, the court would say, well, you can't do that, because in these non-commercial contexts, that would be a First Amendment violation, because the standard for non-commercial speech is even higher. So this is an example. There are other cases in the First Amendment context where I think you see this similarly, including a case called Reed versus Town of Gilbert, Arizona, which is on the Supreme Court's docket for this term, but I'm short on time, so I won't go into that. Last context, international trade law. So this is taking it from the state courts to the federal courts and now looking at this internationally. I think you're seeing some of the same thing. So there was a proceeding challenging a piece of the Family Smoking Prevention and Tobacco Control Act brought by the government of Indonesia, challenging a provision of the law that prohibited all flavored cigarette products with the exception of menthol. And Indonesia said, well, that is trade discrimination because you are exempting menthol, which is primarily domestic, but you are prohibiting the sale of clove cigarettes, which are almost all produced in Indonesia. And so that was the challenge. The WTO dispute resolution panel and then the appellate body agreed with Indonesia on that and found that that was a violation of the U.S. government's trade commitments. And the problematic part is the reasoning here by the court was that these are like products, is the legal term, and you are discriminating in favor of a domestic product and against a foreign product. And in looking at likeness, it looked at things like physical characteristics, tariff classifications, and so forth. It did not look and said essentially you couldn't look at public health, market share, political considerations. And you know, the history of this is pretty clear. Newport is an example. They're the highest selling brand of menthol. But menthol cigarettes account for more than 25% of the U.S. cigarette market. Clove cigarettes on a good day accounted for 0.1% of the U.S. cigarette market. And you know, when this went through Congress, there was an attempt to include menthol in there, but there was a general feeling that if you tried to prohibit menthol, the whole bill would fall apart and not pass, and the only way to get this passed was to exempt menthol out of it. And so that's what happened, and the WTO said that's not okay, which basically means it's saying that compromise here is not an acceptable reason for making these distinctions. And, you know, I think obviously from a public health perspective, we would prefer to have menthol prohibited. But doing something is generally better than nothing in the context of public health. But here you have the WTO saying that can't be done. And this is going to keep coming up as an issue in the international trade context. There's the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership that are being negotiated that are going to make it easier for governments and foreign corporations to bring these types of challenges when they feel they're being discriminated against. So I'm already over my time, but I'm going to quickly sum up on what these cases have in common. So I think you're seeing an aversion to incremental regulation and a rejection of compromise in a bunch of different contexts. And I think the reason for that is pretty clear, that this is really a stalking horse for undoing regulation. I don't think people are concerned about the lack of consistency. I think they're concerned about being regulated. And so I think this is the doctrine that people are latching onto to try to, or set of doctrines that people are latching onto to try to address that. And I also think that this, sort of like the nanny state, which is I think another important issue, this connects to something deep in the psyche and sort of resonates with people. So I cannot tell you how many times I'm asked almost every day, well, if smoking is so bad, why don't you just ban it? And you know, I think that's an argument that doesn't make sense from a policy perspective, but there's something intuitive about that that makes sense. And so I think industries are sort of latching onto that and trying to take advantage of that. So the problem is these doctrines make public health regulation much more difficult. And I think the bigger provocative issue is that this is not just about public health. I think public health is sort of the canary in the coal mine. But this is really about democratic decision making. This is really a set of doctrines that are trying to make it harder for regulation to actually occur and for there to be a democratic decision-making, because democratic decision-making is always about compromise. That's one of its inherent features. And if you're seeing a set of doctrines that basically penalize people for compromise, that's going to be a significant problem. So I will just end with, this is a very old Supreme Court case. It says, to be able to find fault with the law is not to demonstrate its invalidity. The problems of government are practical ones, and may justify if they do not require rough accommodations. And this is, of course, not always true. If you're talking about fundamental rights or equal protection violations, then there are contexts in which that doctrine shouldn't be applied. But generally for public health and for most kinds of government action, this is the standard that should be applied. And I think you see, my concern is that you see a whole bunch of doctrines that are trying to erode that fundamental principle. So long way to go on this project, but I would love your feedback, and here's my information. Thank you.
All right, we have about 20 minutes for questions. I don't know about you, but I've been provoked. So these talks are, I mean, so interesting, and one of the reasons that we use the word provocative is it really does create in you this like tension of like, yeah, I agree with that, but wait, I agree with that too, and it just really shows how important lawyers are in public health. So do we have any questions for our panel? Yeah.
I don't have a question. I have a comment in the spirit of academic debate. My name is Liz Geltner, and I am a professor of college in the City University of New York School of Public Health. In addition to public health law, I do environment. And I just want to make a comment that climate change is not a future problem or a niche environmental issue. And I'm going to give three brief examples. Here in New Orleans, the flooding of Katrina, the and the flooding from Sandy in New York and New Jersey is the result of sea level rise that has already occurred and is going to continue to occur. Vector-borne diseases like Lyme disease, chikungunya, and malaria are spreading more because we've already seen warm earthing, and so we're seeing spread and expansion of vector-borne diseases. And the last one is the droughts that we've had and we've experienced in the past couple years that are causing devastation to our agriculture, again, are because of the earth warming. So this is not a future problem. It's a current problem. It will have future implications in many different trends. And it's just something that we need to invest in.
No, and I think I agree completely, you know, but I think those also, to me, are examples that demonstrate the difference. When I say it's a future problem, is that the public health law solution currently, you're right, they're current effects. But then when we think about it, we're like, so build a higher seawall, right? Or build pumps outside of New York, right? And so the solutions are focused on the current effects of climate change. And when I mean, talking about a future problem, I'm thinking about it in terms of the big fundamental causes of the problem, right? That those are more future-looking, right? I guess it's more, I think it's a theoretical problem, that the public, listen to what I'm saying, the public health law would focus entirely on current solutions. And if we look at current solutions that are being implemented, they are. Move the property back. That's my point. That's not
the solution. That's really easy, and it may be politically difficult, is putting a tax on carbon and having methane reductions. And if we do both of those now, we're going to reduce a lot of these other public health effects.
So you're 100% right, and that's my point. The public health lawyers are not talking about it at all. The health department said, we need to move the property back to River Drive. Or we got to do something about this, and they say, get the lawyer to help us move the
Well, that's what the EPA Clean Power Plan is proposing. That's part of it. It's not a tax because it's a compromise. It's not going into the
But
it is law that's trying now to deal with the problem.
Right, and this, I think this entire conversation is also demonstrating the point I'm making, is that we're arguing about the goings-on now stuff. The field doesn't talk about, like, wait a minute, how do we put the tax on cars? How do we do Right, environmental law is, and another thing is not going on, but the public health law doesn't think about that. That's, you know, that is sort of what I'm saying. Does that make sense? You may not be
I'm glad that we're obsessed with here at this conference, because I think that the public health community is now finally joining the conversation and making it look not just as environmental. And the thing I always like to bring to environmental is that a lot of the premier public health things like sanitation and clean water are actually environmental policies that have had enormous public health implications. And so we need to keep going back to doing it and seeing what kinds of ways we can control exposures. Very much it's on an environmental level in order to deter a lot of the problems, many of which are not, as you said, infectious diseases, but chronic diseases that have these sorts of environmental effects, including things like endocrine disruptors and other types of things.
I mean, part of the problem in climate change is we have a whole segment of our population who doesn't believe it's a thing, a problem, right? So, I mean, and then there's the whole lag time problem, which I think is what, you know, Jason is talking about, where we have the time between a policy being implemented and the time before you actually see an effect is a problem in trying to push forward public health regulations and public health laws, because it's hard to convince somebody that needs to be done in the first place, and then once you do it, it's hard to convince somebody that something's happened that's going to have an impact. So it's going to be a sticky wicket. And yes?
One thing was interesting too, this is a common experience, about the issue of how something simple can become, in the legal process, a very complicated thing. In Los Angeles County, for example, we recognize that in California, we had a regulation that required vaccination of dogs at 4 months of age. But in reality, the vaccine can be done at 3 months of age, and every other state in the United States had it at 3 months of age. All we want to do is go in there, change the word from 4 to 3. But by the time you're through, it was just incredible. The anti-vaccinationists that would come into the mix. Now this is an opportunity to get to this law and things like this. So in reality, we end up oftentimes a lot of unexpected consequences. We did prevail, and I'm very pleased about that, but it was a very interesting experience to learn that. Now, I remember one of the legislators, Dr. Pan, was saying, you know, this is the process. You know, you've got to find something that 50% of the lower house will go with, 50% of the higher house, 50%, I mean, the governor will sign, and then later the courts will uphold. So by the time you get through that, you're getting sausage mix. It's an interesting process.
I mean, I think that's another great example. I think in some way we've lost our sort of civic life, so the idea of the sort of public, right? I mean, I think, you know, I'm giving a talk in class on Monday about anti-vaccine. You know, people were saying it causes autism, right? Which, even though that's not true, doesn't seem to be relevant to the belief that it does, right? But then there's this idea that even if it did, we still might do it, right? People have bad reactions to vaccines all the time, right? And it is, the argument about vaccination is not about you, really, right? So yeah, for me, it's that sort of idea that's public.
Question for Ms. Madden. Your study, it kind of like looked at mostly helpful laws. I wonder, do you have insight into recently enacted unhelpful laws? I was at a presentation yesterday with someone from ASTO, and she said that there have been a number of new laws enacted that criminalize taking drugs when you're pregnant, and that has made it very hard to get pregnant mothers into treatment, and that might have a follow-on effect for overdoses, she thought. But that was new to me. I haven't had a chance to check it out.
So we heard, I mean, like I said, we focused on these 7 that were picked in for 2010. I think we'll be revisiting the question of whether we need to expand our list in terms of other areas, whether they're helpful or not. Again, you're helpful or not, I think, again, we need to go down the evaluation path, because, I mean, we're still so, like, so many about pain management clinic laws, there's like 11 states. What's really happening? Florida is really our first instance of actually looking at these laws and the effects of laws and the impact on, you know, the overdose, you know, rate. So I think we need to first determine in these areas of law that we focused on, are they helpful or are they effective? What's the impact? So studying that, then also, you know, should we be looking at other areas of law as well? So I think keeping that running list, and what we tend to do is we definitely consult with the experts in the field and look at the, you know, research and the evidence base. So I think it's one of those things where learning more, and hopefully, you know, we'll definitely be looking at all the other areas of law too. But right now, we haven't. So,
yeah.
I'm wondering if there's a chance that looking at type 2 diabetes stigma is going to get in the way of shifting social norms against obesity.
Are you endorsing shifting social norms against obesity?
Yeah.
Okay. Just want to be clear in your position. Yeah, it's always a concern, right? I mean, that's always a concern of anti-stigma mechanisms, especially when you start talking about health stigma. If there are certain kinds of health behaviors or conditions which people think ought to be denormed, right, then there's always a risk of slowing down the denormalization process by opposing stigma. Sure. There's always a trade-off, right? And that's probably why I sort of, at a disrespectful rate of speed, race through that normative framework, right? Because I think you have to think about, well, there's always a trade-off, so really we're faced with a normative question, right? You're ethically, what ought we do, right? There's a downside no matter what we do. My argument would be, and this is beyond the scope of what I presented, my argument would be that the corrosive and ethically problematic aspects of stigma outweigh by a fair margin whatever consequences would flow from the slowing down of the denormalization of obesity. And unlike you, I have some questions about the denormalization of fatness, right? I'm not so ready to endorse that as quickly. So I would have less of a problem with it in that case. But you're right. I mean, there's no doubt that's a risk of sort of aggressively going after and implementing anti-stigma mechanisms.
So you don't think there's anything to look at an inheritable race and stigma around race versus something that's a risk behavior?
So I'm not trying to understand the question.
So, you know, I understand we don't want stigma around something that's an inheritable behavior, right? But what about, you know, something that's a behavior issue?
I see your point. I guess what I would say is, and this again was sort of a larger conversation, right? But one of the things we know about risky health behaviors in general is that they're strongly socially patterned, right? They follow a very strong social gradient, right? So people who are lower on the social gradient are much more likely than affluent people to engage in all of the risky behaviors that everybody is concerned about, right? So I guess what I want to say is there are structural constraints no matter what you do, whether we set it up as something that's sort of inherited versus something that's sort of a choice. Those choices are powerfully determined by people's life conditions, right? And so either way you look at it, my view would be those life conditions, those inequalities are what's driving distributions of stigma anyway, right? And so I would want to say, I guess I'm not as comfortable with that distinction, is what I'd say.
Yeah.
Two things, a comment and a question. So,
one, two.
This is the Lord speaking.
Speak, Lord.
Okay.
This is really hard. Okay. Why don't you give it a try?
So my comment is I don't envy the CDC with the the evaluation is certainly going to be very important going forward with all these different laws. but just even in the the Good Samaritan stuff, you're looking at. And you said 8 states, but now it's up to 22 states plus D.C., so it's only going to get more complicated. So I appreciate the work you're doing, but I don't have to be doing the evaluation on that. And then my question is, I'd like to hear from Dr. Goldberg on, he's talking about the stigma on pain, but I'm wondering if you could comment on all the different prescription drug laws that are coming out across the country. Are they actually intensifying stigma against pain and intensifying stigma against
That's a really good question. So I should disclose the title. I have a book on ethics and pain. The title is Beyond Opioids. So full disclosure is I think we spend way too much time thinking about how to improve and compress inequalities in the treatment of pain. I think we spend way too much time talking about opioids. You're just going to say opioids aren't important. That's not what I'm saying, okay? I'm just saying I think they're actually more distinct public health problems than most people think they are. I don't think they're the same. We treat them as if they're the same. So that's full disclosure. That being said, the issue of do these laws instantiate or do they reify sort of stigma against chronic pain sufferers is a real question. I would want to say yes, probably. Although a lot of those laws are really directed at the gatekeepers, right? I mean, they're directed at the prescriber. So a little bit different than sort of fueling or intensifying stigma against actual pain sufferers themselves. I want to call this quasi-legal because I'm not sure it's legal to be honest with you. The intervention that concerns me much more is the widespread use of opioid agreements or opioid contracts. I mean, they're called contracts, but are they really enforceable law? I seriously doubt it. But that's the one that really concerns me, right? And I have some material that I've written, and I'm actually interested in doing some actual studies as well. Nobody's actually asked pain sufferers at all whether or not medication adherence contracts stigmatize them. Nobody's asked them, which I can't believe. There's this huge argument going about whether these things are okay, let alone whether they're effective. But nobody's even asked pain sufferers how these things make them feel. I mean, do they feel stigmatized by this? Which I think is sort of a crucial question to ask. So I'd say the laws are a concern, but what's going on with those medication adherence contracts, which are rapidly becoming standard of care for the treatment of pain, that's to me a sort of a more pressing and a more urgent issue.
And to add to that, I think we had a public health law program email, and every time pain management clinic laws have passed, we have had people reach out to us, pain sufferers, and telling us their stories and, being like, we feel. So I do think they're feeling that, and they tell their story in great detail and sort of like, how can you help us get our, we need the pain meds, and we're feeling like we can't, there's just so many, different things that we have to go through, a lot of barriers that we're legitimate users. So so we are hearing from the community. So I think, further study and sort of talking to people is important.
Is that going to be part of your evaluation, whether or not they're going to increase?
Well, we haven't specifically looked at it. I think right now we'll have to talk to our scientists and really we've had a lot of discussion. I think there's going to be for a lot of different kinds of evaluations. So I think this point's too early to tell. I think it's an interesting idea. Definitely, we'll be taking feedback to our people from what we've heard here today. So
just FYI, NIH has a CFA right now on stigma in general. So if anybody wants to do that study I was talking about getting pilot data on the prevalence of chronic pain stigma, please go on with your bad self and then tell me about it. Okay? It's not my idea.
Any other questions? Going once? Okay, well, I will put in a shameless plug for the law section. If you have enjoyed what you heard today and you love debating and talking about this stuff, about how to use law and policy to address public health problems, we would love to have you join us in the law section. You can now have a second affiliation for free. APHA allows that, so we would encourage you to join us, and we throw a good party. So thank you all for being here on the last day of the conference, and I hope you travel home safe.